Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the University of California Board of Regents. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here every Thursday from 4 to 5 talking with authors, editors, agents, and poets about everything and anything having to do with writing. Today my guests are M.J. Rose, author of Lip Service, and Lillian Motes, author of Legacy of Shadows. My first guest is M.J. Rose. Her book, Lip Service, was published by Pocket Books. As Newsweek has said, the erotic thriller Lip Service owes its success to higher technology. Lip Service was first sold through the author's website, then on Amazon.com. It was later picked up by Doubleday Book Clubs, becoming the first literary selection drawn directly from online sources, and the book club's first self-published acquisition. M.J. Rose is a former advertising whiz whose commercial for the NYPD is in the broadcasting collection of the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Are you with us, M.J.?
I am.
Hi, welcome.
Hi, thanks.
Please tell us about the theme for Lip Service.
Lip Service is a story about a woman's adventure, a woman's journey of self-discovery, wrapped up in an erotic blanket and a little bit of a thriller.
Mm-hmm. And you sent it originally to mainstream publishers.
Yeah, I originally had an agent, and she actually got two offers from two mainstream editors, initial offers, saying that they wanted to buy it, and they were taking it to their marketing committees, which unfortunately is how things are done now.
Mm-hmm.
And the marketing committees nixed the deals because they didn't know how to market a book that was erotic and a thriller.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a term then called erotic thriller. And as I'm sure a lot of your listeners know, they're interested in writing, that the publishing industry has become very, very involved in pigeonholing books and finding a niche for them so they can say, this is like X, Y, or Z,
mm-hmm.
or calling them a romance or a mystery. And if the phrase that a book is doesn't exist yet, they don't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
So my agent sadly said that she didn't know what to do, and I should go write another book because all the editors loved it. So
how wonderful.
Yeah, it was really a big, exciting moment. So I started actually doing research for another book, which had to do with the Internet. And it was while I was doing that research that it was 1996, 97, and I really discovered the Internet and started understanding its capabilities and its power. And I had this crazy idea that if I put Lip Service up on my website and offered it as what I called an electronic download, because nobody had ever done an e-book or coined the phrase yet,
mm-hmm.
that maybe I could get some readers, and that maybe I could get enough readers that my agent could then go back to the publishers and say, remember that book you didn't like? Well, she figured out how to market it, so here she's got a new book, so you want to look at this new book, and you can market it the same way, you can look at what she did on the old book.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought what was going to happen happened, but what happened was I started getting unbelievable readership and unbelievable reviews online, and the Doubleday Book Club and the Literary Guild literally discovered the book on Amazon, and when that hit and the press started on that, my agent held an auction and sold its pocketbook.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of selling it online, how did you market it? How did people find out about it?
Well, the thing that is so different about the Internet as opposed to any other medium is that in every other medium, your audience has to come to you. They have to find out about you from someplace. But on the Internet, you can go to your audience. And that's what I had realized, and that was the big discovery for me, and since then the big discovery for a lot of people who were interested in marketing. What I did was I used search engines to find websites that appealed to women who felt comfortable with their own sexuality, women who liked to read, and using those two criteria, I put together a list of about 200 websites and started writing to them using the reviews that I was getting.
Mm-hmm.
And those websites started to review the book. And so I was going directly to my audience without anybody in the middle. And I was giving away the prologue for free and another chapter because the prologue was very erotic. And so I also had another chapter that was the book is a real story. It's not, you know, it's not pornography.
Right.
It's not based on sex. There is a very sexual part to the book, but I took a chapter that had nothing to do with the sexual part of the book. And between those two chapters, I got about 100 websites to start reviewing the book and writing about what I was doing because nobody had ever heard of putting a book up on the web before. It turned out that at the same time that I was doing it, Martin Eberhardt was creating the eRocket Reader, and Hardshell Word Factory was coming into existence, and we all seemed to have had the same idea within the same couple of months without knowing about each other.
Mm-hmm.
We've all done pretty well. So that's kind of what happened.
So was the fact that it did really well on the Internet, must have factored into the auction, and then I would imagine a wonderful advance.
It factored into, it did well on the Internet, which got it a lot of attention, and the reviews were really wonderful. But what's interesting, when it came down to a publisher buying it, I was still a first-time novelist. And the fact that I'd sold 1,500 copies of this book online certainly made it interesting to them. But what my editor said is that she really loved the book, and that's why she bought it, because she thought it was a great story. They still didn't quite know how easy or how difficult it was going to be to market as a book in a bookstore, because it still has this erotic bent to it. And they've since bought my second novel, which is a much... which doesn't have the same kind of eroticism in it. It's a bit of an easier sell.
Mm-hmm.
My advance was a good advance, but not in any way a crazy advance.
Mm-hmm. So when you first started selling it through your website, was it a downloadable sort of, here are so many manuscript pages, or was it in any kind of sort of desktop published form?
No, there was nothing like that then. I know this sounds crazy because it was only a year. It was only a little over a year ago. It was about 17 months ago. But it didn't. These e-book things didn't exist, and so there was no form to put it in other than a typical manuscript in a Microsoft Word document or a rich text document that you could pick up either way you wanted. But what happened was after a couple of months of me having it up there that way, I was getting so many requests for print copies. People didn't want to read it that way. That I also printed the book as a trade paperback and sold both of those things, the ebook and the trade paperback, from my website.
Mm-hmm.
And Amazon only sold the trade paperback.
Now, how did Amazon get interested?
It's not that. It's that anybody with a book
can
that's published traditionally in its form, that looks like a book that has an ISBN number, anybody can join Amazon's Advantage program, which gives you a page that looks like any author's page. It gives you a book cover. And they take 5 books on consignment if you're in a small press like this. And as they get orders, they pay for the books that they sell once a month, every month on time. And they order new books as they get new orders.
Mm.
So anybody can do it.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, since all this has happened, and I've been in Time and Forbes and
Newsweek
and Business 2.0 and all these crazy things, I've gotten over 1,000 requests for help, people asking me for help. So I finally just wrote a book called The Secrets of Our Success, How to Publish and Promote Online. And the craziest thing is that when lip service happened and everybody said, oh, this is so exciting, you must be so glad that, you know, you got all this attention, I said, yeah, I'm just lucky that I'm the first one. Because who's ever second isn't going to get as much attention.
Mm-hmm.
Little did I know that I became the second e-author to be picked up by Doubleday and the Literary Guild last week when they bought my e-book, The Secrets of Our Success, to make as a featured alternate selection over the summer. And we're now shopping the print version. So it's history repeating itself all over again.
That's a great story.
Yeah, and that book you can order both of them from my website, which is real easy. It's mjrose.com.
Mm-hmm. This is KUCI 88.9 FM. My guest is MJ Rose, author of Lip Service. Tell about how the story came about for Lip Service.
Two different things happened. I was at a dinner party, and I saw a couple interacting with each other, and there was a very strange dynamic to the way they were dealing with each other. It was obviously a very sexless marriage. He was very controlling. She was very, she was like a shadow of him, and they intrigued me. And then a couple of months later, they stuck in my mind, and a couple of months later, I was in a hotel, and my phone line got crossed with someone else's phone line, and I heard a phone sex conversation. And somehow, I have no idea how, these two things kind of coalesced, and I wound up writing a book about that woman in that marriage who winds up getting involved writing a book about phone sex and then having phone sex and how that phone sex teaches her about her own sexuality and ultimately gives her the courage to find out that she can do things, not sexual things, but things with integrity that her husband doesn't think she should do. And that gives her a sense of herself, and she's finally able to make some decisions about her life.
Had you written fiction before?
I wrote a book previous. Well, I wrote three novels that I call my trial novels. they're gone. Nobody will ever see them. They were me teaching myself to write. And then I did write one book before Lip Service, which is how I got my agent. And not surprisingly, she'd had the same problem with that book. She'd gotten two editors at the same, actually, the same two publishing companies that later wanted Lip Service. Two editors to want the books, but marketing departments who said, we don't know what to do with this book. In that case, it was because it had an unhappy ending, and they felt that they couldn't sell a first novelist with an unhappy ending, unless it was literary fiction, and I write more mainstream commercial fiction. So I got killed because I had an unhappy ending, and then I went and wrote Lip Service, and then, you know, that's what happened. It's been a very frustrating 12 years, but it's finally worked out okay.
So what kept you going during those 12 years?
Oh, insane determination. I never, I just always knew that I was, I always knew I was a writer. And I had friends who along the way would say, you know, I know you really want to do this, but don't you think that it's like you've given it enough time and you should give up and go back to advertising because you're so successful at advertising and make a lot of money and just like enough already. And I'd think, okay, I'll stop. I'll stop writing. And I will. And then I'd start thinking about what else I would do and what advertising would be like to go back into it full time. And I couldn't give up.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM. My guest is MJ Rose, author of Lip Service. I'm curious what section of the bookstore your book sits in. Is it in literary fiction? Is it in thrillers?
No, it's in regular. Bookstores don't separate it between literary fiction and general fiction. I mean, it's not in mysteries. It's not in romance. It's not in science fiction. They separate it that way. It's in general fiction. It's, you know, it's in the same section that Kurt Vonnegut is in, or a new, I mean, actually a new Danielle Steele is in that section.
Interesting.
And so Susan Isaac. It's just called main fiction.
Now, you also write nonfiction. How did the two go together for you, fiction and nonfiction?
I never wrote nonfiction except for advertising.
But the secrets of...
Yeah. What happened was I started writing letters to people, answering emails, when people would ask, write me and say, how do I do this part of it? How do I do that part of it? I started writing these emails. And each one would wind up being like 8 to 10 pages as I answered that question. And I started realizing that what I had was the seeds of a book, and I just expanded all those things. Writing nonfiction for me was just talking about what I'd gone through, because I haven't written nonfiction about a subject that I'm not personally immersed in. And I think that's also very different if you start writing nonfiction that isn't your, where your expertise is. I think it's a different discipline, and not one that I'm going to go into.
How does advertising, or how does your background in advertising affect writing fiction? Not at all,
but I do believe completely and totally that the reason that I'm the first e-author to be picked up by mainstream publishers is completely because my advertising background. Because I was able to figure out how to market Lip Service. And that was all because of my advertising knowledge.
Right.
I was able to take that book and know what to do with it online and get it to the people who needed to know about it. So I think it was the two disciplines of being a writer and being an advertising person that made the success happen.
The cover of the book. talk about that. I read that you test marketed this cover. I did.
I had four covers, and we test marketed the cover at the Stanford Mall in front of Victoria's Secret. The cover that is the cover one. We had no idea how erotic the cover is if you turn it upside down. We simply, it's a Greek sculpture of a woman, flopped, so it's a woman looking at herself, basically, which is what the book is about. And we put it up there and we sold it, and I didn't know anything about the strange thing that happened to the cover until Pocketbooks bought it, and they said, we don't know whether or not to keep your original cover because of what happens when you turn it upside down. And I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. So they turned it upside down and showed it to me. And I went, oh, my God. And I called my friend, who also happened to be the book designer, and I said, Mickey, turn the book upside down. And she said, oh, my God, I had no idea. Well, strangely enough, they went with that book cover, and they are not going with it for the trade paperback because they found out that a lot of bookstore owners felt very uncomfortable about hand-selling the book. They loved it, but they felt very uncomfortable about hand-selling it because the cover is so erotic. So I think the new cover has something really tame, like a pair of lips on it.
In a piece that was in New York Magazine about you and your book, it said that basically the turning point came when an editor at Doubleday spied your reviews on Amazon.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Well, Erica Tsang is an editor at the Doubleday Book Club in the Literary Guild, and she spends a lot of time on the Internet, and she had been on some sites where she saw buzz about this book. You know, she heard about this book, and so she went to Amazon and looked it up and read. At the time, there were 30 reviews, and I think 25 of them were five-star reviews. And she wrote me a letter, which I thought was a joke. I thought some friend of mine was doing this joke, saying that she worked for Doubleday Direct, and she represented these two book clubs, and she was interested in the book. Could she have a copy? So I sent her a copy, and 2 weeks later, she called up, and she said, we want to buy the book.
Interesting. So all of this just must have... Well, were you jaded at that point, or did it still blow your mind that it was happening like this?
It blew my mind. I absolutely still, it's only been, it's not a year yet. That happened, she found that book at the end of February, and they bought the book the first week of March. And Pocketbooks bought it the end of March. So it isn't even a year. And I am still totally do not believe that any of this happened. But it's weird when you're a writer. I still live in the same apartment I lived in. I still do the same thing every day. I didn't make the kind of money that would change my lifestyle. I just made enough money that I didn't have to do any freelance advertising this year. So my life isn't any different. And all of this stuff has happened outside of my life. I mean, it's been in magazines and stuff, but that doesn't affect me in any way. And so I don't actually believe it's happened to me. I think it's happened to this other person named MJ Rose, which is my pen name, which makes it even more complicated because it really hasn't happened to me. It's happened to this other person, and I'm really happy for her. And she's made sure that I can, like, write for a living now, and that's about it. You know?
Interesting. Well, how wonderful to be able to do that.
Yeah, it is. It is.
How about do you get a lot of fans wanting you to tell them how the book is based on your life, or do they try to draw a correlation between the character in the book and you?
Yeah, I don't know why people do that. I know other writers who say that it happens to them like crazy, too. Yeah, everybody wants to know that, and it's not based on my life at all. In fact, after I wrote the book, my life became a little bit more like her life, like Julia in Lip Service, because I wound up doing... in my marriage, what she wound up doing in her marriage, which I'm not going to get into. But if the book isn't about, I'm nothing like Julia.
Interesting.
I think that every writer does it in their very first novel. And that's one of those trial novels that I threw out. I think that I was very much in that book.
You actually threw it out?
I literally threw it out. I literally do not have a copy of it. Because, you know, when I read it over... When I was working on it, I read it a lot, and then 5 years later, I read it again, and it was so much a nonfiction bad memoir
mm-hmm.
that had no purpose at all for existing. That I decided there wasn't a sentence in it I needed to save. If there was a sentence that good, I'd rewrite the same sentence in another book. But I didn't really ever want to look at it again. I was horrified by it.
What about your second one?
I threw that one out, too. That one was even worse. I hadn't figured out plot at all. And that was just one long 500-page ramble about a subject that wasn't even interesting. Then I took a year. I wrote three that were really bad, and I took a year off. And in that year, I studied five novels. I read them each three times. I outlined each one of them. I tracked the pacing of each one. I tracked the tension and the excitement levels on chart. And I kind of taught myself what plot was, what tension was, what character development was, and how to structure a novel during that year.
What novels were they?
One was Catcher in the Rye.
Mm-hmm.
One was called The Music School by Dennis McFarland.
Mm-hmm.
One was Remains of the Day. One was Mrs. Dalloway by Virginia
mm-hmm.
Woolf. And I can't remember what the last one was. What was the last one?
Intense Study.
Oh, the last one was Rebecca.
Uh-huh. Intense Study.
It was great. It was better than going back to school. It
mm-hmm.
was just fabulous. I also took some master classes at NYU, but they didn't do anything like this did. And I don't think anybody can teach that. I think that you have to do that yourself. You know, I think that you have to discover it yourself. Because if someone tells it to you, I still don't think you get it. I think you have to uncover it.
Interesting. I haven't heard of anyone quite doing that.
No, I haven't actually either. I just started telling people about it. I do another weird thing that I've never heard of when I write a novel.
Mm-hmm.
The first 3 months, I make a book, which is like a scrapbook
mm-hmm.
of my character's life. And I completely, I get photographs of where they live and colors that they like, and I tear out pictures of clothes that they wear, the artwork that's in their houses. I just visualize their entire lives in a notebook. And I write endless notes about them. I interview them. I act as if I'm a psychiatrist, and I have sessions with them all on paper.
Hmm.
And after 3 months, I kind of know them, and then I can start writing about them.
That's great. Yeah, I've never heard of that either.
It's really fun. I just did that, too. I mean, I had a lot of trouble in the beginning figuring out how to develop characters,
mm-hmm.
and it just kind of evolved.
MJ, we're at the end of our time. Do you have any advice for aspiring writers?
Yes, that no matter how long it takes, if you really, really believe in yourself and you really work hard at it, don't give up.
You are such an example of that.
Thank you.
And I wish you great luck with the paperback, and like to have you back on to talk about your other book, too.
Oh, I'd love to. Next winter, the new novel will be coming out.
Excellent.
So give me a call.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was MJ Rose, author of Lip Service. Please stay tuned. We'll be back with Lillian Motz. Don't go away. We're back with the second half of the show, and my next guest is Lillian Motz, author of Legacy of Shadows, published by Three Arts Press. Legacy of Shadows is a small, intimate book, but it's intense, and it's told in the voices of three women, a mother, daughter, and granddaughter. It shows how grief, guilt, and fear wind their way unintentionally through the psyches and emotions of three generations. Lillian Motz is also a poet, artist, and filmmaker, and the award-winning animated art films she's produced with her partner, J.P. Somersalter, have appeared in festivals around the world. Selected films are in the collection of the Museum of Modern Art, and about Legacy of Dreams. It's interesting, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Robert Coles, MD, has said, "This book will hold its readers close and tight, will teach them its remarkable, affecting, and important lesson, that experiences live and last over a family's generations as memories that shape hearts and minds." Are you there, Lillian?
Yes, I am. Hi,
well,
Barbara.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be with you.
Tell me how your wonderful book came to be.
Well, it was a long time in the making, really. 13 years ago, I I started to write this story, although it was different from this story. Legacy of Shadows grew out of a devastating emotional breakdown that I had in my late 20s, which lasted 5 years. And many years after I had recovered from that, I decided that I wanted to try to document that illness, and I at that point was just telling my own story, trying to do it as objectively as I could. And I just got to a point where I couldn't continue, and I put it aside. In the meantime, I had many more insights about my own illness and began to uncover the story of how it had its roots in the lives of my mother and grandmother. And so I returned to the story 8 years later, and I think my unconscious had been working on it all that time, and it was just ready. And I approached it entirely differently. I approached it as fiction. I wrote it as a kind of prose poetry in the format of a journal, in the voices of a grandmother, mother, and daughter. And it's basically the story of how the death of a small child in 1904 reverberates in mysterious ways through the lives of three generations of women.
Interesting. Was it difficult writing about something so painful?
Yes.
It was fun.
It really was too difficult on the first round. But I found that by actually looking at my life through an artistic lens, I was much better able to capture the essence of my experience, and so the story is told largely through metaphor, and I think that kind of creates a bridge between myself as a writer and the reader, because really talking about mental illness it's nearly inexpressible, but somehow I found that if I could find metaphors and compare the inexpressible to things that are in our common experience, that worked for me and somehow gave me a little bit of distance from the pain, and I think sort of protects the reader as well.
Well, in terms of the poetic style, is that simply your wonderful style, or did it evolve into that? Did you find yourself experimenting with different ways to write it?
Once I came back to it in this new mode, I didn't really find that I had to experiment. It was somehow just ripe, and what happened was that, it was a Christmas Eve, and I should have been getting ready to go to a family gathering, and instead I just suddenly felt that I wanted to sit down at the word processor and write a poem in the voice of my grandmother. This was, I hadn't had this notion at all before, and it seemed to come, quite easily, and then I realized that this was how I wanted to approach this story, and then I wrote nearly every day on it, 7 days a week for just about 2 solid years, and I really went through it chronologically, and wrote and rewrote and rewrote as I went, but I didn't change the approach or entirely remove many passages. So it seemed to come out in the final shape, even though there were many, many versions in terms of wording.
Mm-hmm. This is KUCI 88.9 FM. My guest is Lillian Motz, author of Legacy of Shadows. It's been very well reviewed, most recently by the Bloomsbury Review. Are you at all surprised by the overwhelming attention this book has received?
Absolutely. It was, as you can imagine, it was a difficult decision to bring the book out. It was really 3 years after I completed it before I felt really ready emotionally to have my story out there. Even though it's fictionalized, I had made the decision that I didn't I didn't want to try to camouflage the fact that it grew out of my own experience. And not knowing what it was going to be like for me to speak with strangers about things that were so personal, we released the book in a very small way locally. And then I found almost right away that I could tell it was going to be fine. People have been just so warm about this book and have found so much to relate to. And that's what I had hoped for, but I didn't know if I could expect that. I really decided to write the book because at the same time my experience was so unique, I came to realize, as I understood more about the roots of my illness, that there was so much universality in it, because I think, you know, all of us carry an emotional legacy passed down to us by previous generations, and which, you know, grows out of the experiences of our ancestors. And these emotional legacies are passed along often quite unconsciously. And we all have that experience, you know, to bring to this book. So I've been absolutely thrilled by how people have found so much to relate to about this story.
It's also interesting that it is a small press out of, it sounds like a smaller city or town in Illinois, and yet it's gotten so much coverage from major journals, book lists, just lots of places. How did that come to be? Do they have you must actually have a publicist who's doing something.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, this is self-published, and people are always very surprised to find that out. I think even though times are changing so much, and that's gaining a lot of respectability, it's still kind of an uphill battle. I mean, if you say a book is self-published, people often have an image of something that's less than professional. Whereas, you know, we knew in doing this book that the standards, the production standards, had to be almost higher than they would have been mm-hmm. with a conventional publisher. But I just felt as if this was such a personal story, and I was concerned ahead of time with how a commercial publisher might handle it, being about the subject of mental illness. I just didn't want it sensationalized in any way. So I wanted to have, you know, complete artistic control over this. I am an artist as well as a writer. And I had gathered a lot of experience in my first book, which is a collection of my fairy tales done for Cranbrook Press. I was very involved in the production of that. So I felt confident in being able to, you know, to handle the production aspects. The story, I couldn't see myself ever being able to turn this over to an editor. Mm. In that it was so so intimately, you know, a part of the whole process of my illness, my therapy, my growing understanding, family history. It would have been very difficult to turn it over to someone else who might really have wanted to put her own or his own stamp on it. Mm-hmm. So for all those reasons, we decided to publish it ourselves. And it began, book lists, you know, we sent out review copies, probably not nearly as many as a conventional publisher, but we were very fortunate in having Donna Seaman review it at Book List, and with a lovely review, and a long article was written about it in the Chicago Reader by Michael Miner, and that was wonderful. And then we did hire a publicist who's been just terrific. So it's just grown, but grown quietly. And that's the way I've wanted it to be.
It really is amazing. I had no idea this was a self-published book. It looks so unlike a self-published book. It reminds me a little bit of Bird by Bird when it first came out. Pantheon did a nice little hardback copy of it, very high quality, and that's what this looks like to me.
It's thank you.
Really beautiful. You just did it. It's surprising. but and it's also unusual, isn't it, to get reviews for a self-published book?
Yes.
How did you get by it, that it looks so beautiful and you had a publicist? Or?
Well, I think we didn't try to hide the fact that it was self-published. We also weren't making a big deal of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if someone read through the press kit, they would find that because, that was highlighted in the article in the Chicago Reader. But I think it was just, as you say, it doesn't look like it's a self-published book. And we, you know, in the press kit, too, as we developed that, we just, our standards just had to be so high. You know, everything that we produced, we felt needed to somehow represent this book and this press that we created for it. And I think that it worked somehow. It must have given people confidence, and probably most people were never aware, unless they read really thoroughly, that it was self-published. And if they did, they probably began to see it as maybe, kind of a positive and appropriate thing for this book.
Well, it's interesting because I've had agents on who will talk about how you can never get self-published books reviewed. And even books from major publishers, there are certain publishers that reviewers just won't review, and on, and yet this defies all that, and that's a wonderful thing.
Oh, thank you.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM. My guest is Lillian Motz, author of Legacy of Shadows. How did you choose the genre of novel as journal? Was it, again, the way it came out, and had you ever considered publishing it as nonfiction, as a journal, as just tracking something in your life?
Well, that was more my original approach, to write it as nonfiction. But I found that it was in giving myself artistic license that I really freed myself up. But beyond that, I didn't sort of make a rational decision about, what approach to use. When it was ripe, it came out. And I found that writing it with attention to metaphor and meter somehow released a lot of insight and early memories even. And that's something that I can't exactly explain even to myself, although it makes sense to me that, to give you an example, when I would be writing and get kind of stuck at a certain point or just feel I was getting a little stale, I'd get up and take a walk in the woods, and I could feel that the language of whatever passage I was working on, almost working down through my body as I walked. And I think that so many of our deepest memories and insights are really somatic, bodily memories, and that by attending to the meter of the language, something was, really released in this process of writing it. I don't know, as I say, I don't have a real technical explanation for this, but it came to make sense to me.
Would you read a page or two?
No, I'd love to. Any special requests, or shall I just...
Yeah, just pick something.
Okay. I think I'm going to read a passage in the voice of the mother, the middle character. Just to set things up a bit. The book opens with the death of a small child, a 2.5-year-old child of Christiana, the grandmother. And, but, you know, life itself was more fragile for our grandparents and our great-grandparents. So Christiana, the grandmother, dies in her late 30s, as my grandmother did, in the famous epidemic of 1918 to 19. So this passage I'll read is in the voice of her daughter, Lisbeth, who was born shortly after the death of that first child. This is written 7 years after her mother's death. Toronto, March 1926. Painting beneath the skylights at the Academy, I cast shadows. I stand out in three dimensions, don't I? It seems I amuse my professors. She can capture anything we put in front of her, I've heard them say. Everything's easy for Lisbeth. If only they could see me here at home, where nothing's easy and no one sees me. Martin's gone. The twins, grown discontent to be my dolls, have forged their own iron wills, and I lack my mother's skill to make them want to please me. Father had me gather mother's clothes to give away, and yet he singled out one dress to keep. I puzzled at his choice, the slate-gray woolen jersey, long sleeves, high neck, a deeply gathered skirt. It was neither the prettiest nor mother's favorite. Now it hangs in her empty closet like a woolen shadow. Tonight, after my chores, I bent my head into father's room to whisper goodnight. There he was, squeezing the shadow in his arms. I knew at once he'd picked the dress that could best enfold him, the one that could almost return his embrace. Father didn't see me waiting at his door. He'll never speak of this, and I will never dare to. The moment will be closeted with all the others we might have shared. At the Academy, I stand out in three dimensions, don't I? But here at home, Father sees more of a person in Mother's empty dress than he has ever seen in me.
Hmm. Thank you.
Thanks for the chance to read.
That was Lillian Motes, author of Legacy of Shadows. It's interesting. You have a couple of pages of testimonials from various people, from reviewers and such, and you have a lot of noted psychiatrists and psychologists, such as Robert Coles, who are singing the book's praises. I would imagine that helped you with a self-published book, but I would also imagine that coming from a small publisher or a self-published author would be difficult to get those testimonials unless you had something really wonderful, which you do.
Well, thanks very much. Actually, I sent the manuscript to Robert Coles and didn't receive an answer. And then after the book was completed, I decided we decided to send it to him again because from what I knew of Robert Coles, I would have expected that I might have gotten a letter that said, you know, I'm sorry, I just don't have time to read this or something, but I wouldn't have expected to hear nothing. And we found a different address and sent the finished book to him. And he wrote back quite quickly and said that he had never received the manuscript and that, you know, he was happy to give this comment. So I was just absolutely overjoyed and floored.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the publicity that you've had to do. Has that been a big deal with getting this book out there, or was it mostly a big deal in the beginning?
I'd say it's been a pretty big deal just about up until now. I can feel things winding down a bit. This, in fact, is my last scheduled interview, and it's, you know, time to get back to writing again. But I know that I'll need to continue to sort of oversee things. But it really has been more than a solid year of dedication to to being a publisher as well as an author. And it, I mean, it is a huge undertaking, I guess, with, you know, our talking about how gratifying this has been, that I, you know, I shouldn't just ignore the fact that it it has been overwhelming and exhausting, and but it's, you know, it's turned out to be worth it.
Hmm. What sort of research did you have to do for this book? Did you do any, or did it all kind of come out of you?
I needed to do a little bit of research. In one subject was, you know, the influenza epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
There is a passage, it's the passage that was quoted in the Bloomsbury Review, is about ice skating. I had needed to find a passage that could convey the lasting impact of the death of this child on the first character, Christiana's mind, and an incident that I created was this one where she's watching her husband figure skating. And this grew out of my knowledge that my grandfather had been an excellent figure skater. He had done this, however, in Canada, and the way I wanted to work the story, they would still have been in England at that time, so I had to do some research into, you know, where in England there was any skating going on, since the climate is different there. And so, you know, little things like that. But for the most part, this grew out of, you know, well, in the case of Christiana, my scant knowledge of her life. You know, she died when my mother was only 14, and then in the character who represents my mother, that was really more through what I knew of my mother's life and the turning points in her life, and, you know, many of the things grew out of stories that I heard over and over again, and, you know, of course, embellished and altered them somewhat, but in terms of their emotional tone, you know, they were things, for the most part, that I had been told.
We're at the end of our time. I wonder if you have anything you'd like to say to writers who are struggling to tell their own very personal stories.
I think that my advice after, you know, going through this whole process would be to really be true to yourself, and you know, just not sell out your standards or your feelings of honesty to your own experience. And then, you know, when the work is finished, you'll find a way, I think, to bring it to fruition on your own or with a conventional publisher. But I think just, you know, sticking to your highest personal standards is going to get you a lot closer to the place you want to be. And then in the end, no matter what happens, you can take satisfaction in that work.
Something we all need to remember. It's a hard one in these days of wicked publishing.
It is. It is, really.
Lillian, I thank you for coming on the show.
And it's really been a pleasure for me, Barbara. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. And come back.
Thanks. I'd love to.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest was Lillian Motes, author of Legacy of Shadows. Before that, MJ Rose, author of Lip Service. Next week, my guest will be New York literary attorney and author Jeff Herman. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Writers on Writing is also internet accessible at kuci.org. You can email me at bdemarcob@aol.com. Thanks for listening, and do remember, it's all about writing like there's no tomorrow.